Hello. Going to continue with the formal discussion of HPF today. The homework is should be sitting on the web. It's a rather straightforward one using the programming lab. On the next two lectures after this, I'm going to be away, and at least in the first one, what will happen is Tom Hout will give some examples, go through some real HPF codes as examples, and also discuss Fortran 90 in detail, because he's written a lot of high-performance Fortran. So. So we were up to here last time. We were going through a line, and if you remember, a line basically told you how the distribution of different data structures were aligned with respect to each other, and this particular foil here tells you that you can do aligning even when the things being aligned have different dimensions. In the first case, we have a two-dimensional array, and the align statement has a particular index j. So that says the jth column of A is aligned with B. In the second one is a little more interesting. We have a star instead of J. That says that we do this for all values of J. So that means that the rows of A are distributed in the same way as B, but the columns of each column of A is going to be stored within the processor. So we are going to distribute over the first index of A, and this index of A is just going to sit inside the processor. So that's quite a common strategy or need in a particular application, where if your work involves a lot of work up and down a row or up or down a column, you'd want to keep that column within the processor, because otherwise you're going to spend a lot of communication. Whenever you do a distribute, there's going to be some implicit communication if you move within that particular index value. Here's a opposite example where we take a one-dimensional object and align it with a two-dimensional object, and this has a different meaning, namely in the first case at the top it's where we have a star in the second index of the template. It says that that A is going to be a replicated array, because it's going to have to this A is going to be the same A over all columns of the template. In the second example there, where I specify a specific index, for the second index a template that says A is only placed in part of a template. So that's a rather peculiar construct, because it says that some of the processors will not have A, and some of them will, because we're placing A only in a particular column of a template. So I would consider these examples, and maybe I'm wrong, as slightly artificial. They're an example of taking the language, seeing what it implies as a language, namely the language of doing aligning, but aligning was not sort of expected to be used in this complicated fashion. Yeah, no. Sorry? The compiler keeps it consistent. The compiler's ordered to keep it consistent. I mean, replication is let me think whether that's true. No, you see, replication is not normally done in this way. This is sort of a peculiar way of replicating. Normally, you would replicate by broadcasting, because we're assuming a MIMDI machine here. Well, let's assume a MIMDI machine. For a MIMDI machine, even when we often would have a vector A, which was, say, even distributed over a set of processors, not all of them, but there would normally be no assumption that vector A was the same vector A. It was not replicated. It would normally just be whatever it was. And so, in fact, normally in a typical sense of scalars are the easy example. If we have scalars in an HPF program, they typically do not have the same value in each processor. So I would see this as somewhat dubious, in my opinion, syntax. Not at all clear that this is worth implementing. I may be wrong. Somebody may have found this of great value, but it's not what was intended. Some of these original came from a memo I wrote several years ago, and I had not got that application in mind. It doesn't mean it isn't a good application, but it doesn't fit the spirit of what you normally do in data parallelism very obviously. So I believe that some of the problems with HPF as a language is it's actually a rather nicely defined and elegantly defined language, but I believe some of the complexity of the compiler is coping with possibilities that are not obviously of great value. Let's say of unproven value. Things that are allowed syntactically but are not obviously important in practice. Typically, as far as I know, what you want to do is you do want to some of these you want to do I don't think either of these examples is terribly important. I'm wrong. You would normally just broadcast it. If you wanted to make certain each processor had the same value for something, you'd broadcast that value. Which you do by by one of the intrinsics. So here's the same type of comment. You can do pretty complicated alignments of subarrays on big arrays. But it's not, it doesn't fit my idea of what data parallel programs look like. Although, actually, if you had a complex adaptive mesh, that's sort of how it would look, but I don't think you'd find it very easy to implement an adaptive, complex, patchwork mesh using this technology. It's too clumsy. see, typically the model I have is that this template is a set of data values or fundamental data space of the world we're modeling, and then we have these various components, and we're basically telling the system where these components lie in that space, and these rather complex types of structures don't fit my at least my intuition for what the real world looks like. They often are displaced by one or something like that, because you have a locality or a nearest neighbor structure. So simple displacements, fixed displacements, are quite common. But these more complex structures I consider to be not of clear value. So this is a formal definition of what subscripture allowed. One thing it points out is that you better, all the array subscripts have to evaluate the legal values, which means that if you align something, say here A of I with T of I plus 1, you better dimension T to be 101 if A is dimensioned 100, because otherwise it will consider it an error. So here is an example where we have an array subscript where it's not terribly readable on this foil, but it's we're aligning it with every other element. So here we're showing that we can have in our expressions not only I but 2 times I, and we can do any sort of reasonable arithmetic. That I think is possibly of value. I'm not certain that, however, that's how it would normally be implemented, but that is possibly a value. But I don't think you'd normally implement it like that. You'd normally, I mean, the reason why you might think that's of value, in the classics, when we come to study a lot of PDE iterative algorithms, we have these so-called red-black algorithms, which means we do every other row and every other column. But we don't do it using templates. We take the full array, align it with a simple align statement, and then we use where statements or if statements to select every other one, or we just loop over every other index with a for all statement. We don't do it by defining separate arrays for all the even indices or separate arrays for all the odd indices and do each of them separately. We could do, if we had such an approach, this is the way to do it. But I believe that this is not not the conventional way of thinking about it. So I must admit, if I had, if I was implementing a line, I would restrict the line to having a very simple set of indices. Because there's actually a lot of compiler complexity hidden here. I mean, because to calculate the precise values of indices and do that efficiently at compile time is in general a very difficult problem. So there's a lot of complexity is hidden in this thing. Alright. So the distribute directive should be more complicated than the align statement, because my intuition is, ought to be simple, because we're really defining the relative alignment of the different components of these fundamental data members. With a distribute statement, we're telling you which processes they go on. Now, that in fact, the HPF, whereas for a line, I think HPF is too complicated, for distributed, HPF is too simple. Because what it allows are only the two simplest types of distribution statements, which are insufficient to do a lot of important problems. So at the end of this lecture, or this file set, you'll just see a discussion of HPF2, which has allowed, in my opinion, correctly, more complicated distributed statements, because I consider that the most serious problem with the distributed statement. So some of you may have been present when it was on Monday when I talked about Java. So any statement here I'm making about distribution of arrays is obviously true about distribution of arrays in any language. I mean, there's nothing about Fortran which special here. So I see all the work that went into HPF for discussing array distributions is clearly usable in any other language, because it's nothing to do with Fortran, it's to do with arrays and what parallel programs look like. So I see this, any work one does in this area is clearly of general value in my opinion. So we define the processors directive, so we can have several different processor arrays. The onto syntax allows you to tell it which processors you want to distribute onto. You're allowed, and you often need to do this, you're allowed to specify separate distributions for the different dimensions of an array. So in the first example here, the array temp was block distributed in the first dimension and cyclically distributed in the second dimension. And we'll come back and tell you what, if it's not obvious what block and cyclic is, I'll tell you what block and cyclic with the various integer arguments are later on. So this file here is meant to tell you, give you an example. So we have four processors, which are the four colors. We have a 16-dimensional array, which has a trivial alignment with a 16-dimensional template. Then the first example here is the block distribution, the top left-hand corner. So the block distribution is the one we've seen with Laplace's equation. You take the total number of points in the template, divide it by the total number of processors, and let's suppose it divides exactly. Then you take that number of points and put them in the first processor, the next that number of points in the second processor, and so on. And if it doesn't divide exactly, then you put fewer points in the last processor. So the block distribution is the natural way of doing the optimally sized blocks fitting in a processor, which therefore varies according to the size of the array and the number of processors. Below that we have a block of five. And you see a block of five puts five elements in the first processor, five elements in the second processor, five elements in the third, and in this case here, there's only one element left for the last processor. So that's a relatively uncommon thing to want to do. You would normally want to get this sort of optimal blocking, because this blocking here is inherently load imbalanced, very machine dependent, because it depends on the size of the array, and etc. So I don't think it's terribly common. Cyclic or cyclic with a parameter, however, are quite common. So cyclic is very straightforward. It's if you read some of our early papers, we called it scattered. Cyclic is, and I'll give an example of what this is soon. cyclic. You take element 1 in the first process, element 2 in the second process, element 3 in the third, element 4 in the fourth, element 5 comes back to the first, and so on. So cyclic is the exact opposite of a block. Block tries to maximize the how close things are together, the different indices which have nearby values are hopefully in the same processor. Cyclic does the opposite. It tries to spread the indices as widely as possible among the processors. And in fact, although it's not allowed in Fortran, in HPF, instead of that regular distribution, if you did it with a random number, in many examples you get an equally good, if not better, distribution. That's why we always used to call it scattered. The goal in the cyclic distribution is to scatter the information over the processors, with the main requirement there be an equal amount of work in each processor. And that's actually, that's guaranteed by this strategy here, because if I just keep assigning one to each processor, I am going to get a pretty equal amount of work. Now, cyclic with the number 2 here, or with any number, is sometimes called block cyclic, because cyclic with the number 2 says you take 1 and 2 and put it in the first processor, 3 and 4 in the second processor, 5 and 6 in the third. So you take them in blocks of 2, or if you have cyclic of n, block of n, assign n into one processor, n into the next, and so on. I don't think
you can
it's.
Just do the same thing.
No, the difference between block of 5 and cyclic of 5. Well, I think in this example there's no difference. Maybe somebody knows. What would happen if, I must admit, I'm not terribly familiar with block of 5. So I'm not quite certain what happens when I have an array of size 160. So I'll add this as an extra question. All right, so here we have, take this foil and do it in the case of an array of size 160. What is the distribution? Because I'm not quite certain what block of 5 on 4 processors with 160 elements means. Cyclic of 5 is quite obvious. It's not, you do 5, you do 1 through 5, 21 through 25, 41 through 45 in processor 1, and so on. I'm not certain what block of 5 means with 160 points. So I think the answer to your question comes in the answering of that example. Because it's obvious you're clearly correct that in this example, cyclic of 5 and block of 5 are the same thing. As I'm not quite certain why we have block of 5 anyway, it doesn't strike me as a terribly useful strategy. I'll have to see. Well, this really shows here that you can do the same thing with a two-dimensional array, and you just do it in the obvious fashion. So here I have a 4x4 system and 4 processors. I have a block in the first index and cyclic in the second index. So that means that this processor in the top left has rows 1 and 2, columns 1 and 3, because cyclic says in the columns 1, 2, 3, 4, and in the rows 1, 2, 3, 4. So in the Laplace example, of course, when we did it in 2 dimensions, we had a block-block distribution. Because that's the natural, any partial differential equation in, say 3 dimensions, the natural distribution is block, block, block. Because that's the one that gives you nice little cubic subdomains in each processor, which is the physically, the intuitively natural way to do it. It happens, if you analyze latency, that block, say, well, in an extreme case, block star star, namely only distribute over one of the array, over one of the array indices, and leave the other two inside the processor, or equivalently block block star, distribute over two dimensions, leave the third index in a processor. If you analyze such a distribution, you'll find it has, compared to block block block, it has higher communication overhead in measured in terms of number of bytes needed to be transmitted, but more messages. Sorry, block 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 has fewer bytes but more messages. Block block star has more bytes but fewer messages. And it's a trade-off between latency and bandwidth, which is the best. There was a, I remember back in the beginning of parallel computing, I had a huge argument with a very sweet person in a meeting, because I said, we were discussing essentially matrix algorithms, so essentially Laplace equations in two dimensions. This was right at the beginning. And I said, obviously it's block block. Well, I didn't use those words, but I said, and he said, no, it's block, essentially he says block star, obviously. And the reason was that we were, in some sense, we were both right, because we had the machine we built at Caltech, the so-called Cosmic Cube, which had wonderful latency, very, very low latency. This other individual was using the commercial version of this, the so-called IPSC-1, which had the world's most dreadful latency. It had a millisecond latency on message communication, whereas our machine had a much factor of 50 or 100 smaller latency. And so that made this transition between block block and block star. Alright. So this, we just have a couple of, a couple of foils, or maybe four foils, discussing these two distributions, because these distributions are extremely important, because they cover what you need. If you do these two distributions and worry about doing it in one, two, or three dimensions, depending on the problem at hand, and I pointed out block block versus block star could actually differ depending on the machine, even for a given problem. But these cover what you'll need for a huge variety of algorithms. The only algorithm it does not cover are some very irregular physical simulation problems for which these are not appropriate. But the block and cyclic are by far the most important algorithms. They cover all sort of classic computer science. Any elegant algorithm is going to be block or cyclic. And we know a block is clearly the easiest to understand, because block is the natural geometrical structure. And so for any, if you like, geometrical problem, it's the you would expect block to be the right algorithm. Actually, a good example of where block star is a very important algorithm, and actually better than block block, is the fast Fourier transform. If you do the fast Fourier transform in, say, two dimensions, then if you did it block block, that means that when you do the Fourier transform in X, where you're summing we're summing over rows, then if we do block block, then we have communication, because the block is divided within each row. Then we do it in Y, which is the columns, then we still have communication. So you have communication in all parts of the algorithm. So the right thing to do is to do it block, let's say star block, so that means that all values of X for a given Y are stored in the processor. So when you do the X Fourier transform, there's no communication. Now you have to do the Y Fourier transform. So it turns out the right thing to do is to just do a transpose. So you go from star block to block star, which you can do, as we'll see, with a redistribute statement. Then you would just do one data transformation where data is rolled around the machine in large messages because you're transforming everything. And then you do the FFT in the Y dimension, and it's still stored in it. It's everything stored in a given processor. So that class of algorithm is an example of one which is intrinsically geometrical and two-dimensional, but it's because of the nature of the Fourier transform, which is really summing over rows and columns. It's not local in both x and y. A partial differential equation when discretized is local in x and y, but an FFT goes up and down in rows and columns. It has, therefore, this different type of structure. So there are some amusing and interesting subtleties into the right algorithm to use. But block is essentially geometric. And the reason why block is not right for FFT is that FFTs aren't really purely geometrical, because you're Fourier transforming over all x values. So that is not a local geometrical algorithm. Alright, so cyclic, as I mentioned, was called scattered in our early work, or you could view it as a special case of scattered. And block, if you like, focuses on geometrical structure. It's trying to minimize local communication. Cyclic is concentrating on load balancing. It's trying to spread the data over the processors to guarantee load balance. And we'll go through a couple of examples which we won't bother to discuss here. Matrix inversion and graphics rendering, which illustrate well why cyclic is quite good. Alright. So here we have an example called of matrix inversion, or solution of linear equations. And I've set up a simple example here with an 8x8 matrix, those are little yellow squares, and I have two processors which are either greeny blue or mauve. We're just using the classic way of solving linear equations, and if you formally haven't done that, but probably most of you know the basic structure. When you solve linear equations, the first thing you do is you take the first row and you use it to eliminate the first variable from all equations. So that's equivalent to and then you can iterate that process. So in the first step of matrix inversion, you eliminate row 1 and column 1. Second step, you eliminate row 2 and column 2. Third step, row 3 and column 3. So that's why I've drawn this picture here. After two steps, I've abolished the first two rows and the first two columns. They're not doing anything. They're whatever they were. So if we look at this algorithm here, it has the int, and I do the block. Here I'm doing I only have two, so I can't. I'm doing a block distribution in the columns. And we see that it starts off perfectly load balanced. There are four columns in processor 1 and four columns in processor 2. After two steps, it's highly imbalanced because processor 2 has four columns and processor 1 has two columns. After four steps, all the work is in processor 2. So let's compare that with the cyclic case. Cyclic case, which I shouldn't have done it like this. I should have just done it cyclic in the rows. So because this is not a formally cyclic case. Let's assume these ones here should be blue. So in the cyclic case, I assign rows 1, 3, 5, 7 to the mauve processor, 2, 4, 6, 8 to the green-blue processor. And there is a minor load imbalance, which is sort of inevitable, because if we only have an odd number of rows and columns, then one of them could have one more row and column than the other. But, for instance, after two things have been eliminated, we have the mauve is here. The mauve has still active, columns 3, 5, and 7, and the green glow is 4, 6, and 8. So it's totally load balanced. And at the end here, I say I apologize, these should be green, blue, because I wasn't thinking. It's still totally load imbalanced at that stage. So this is an example, a very typical example of where load balancing in the cyclic distribution works. It retains load balancing because even after I do this sort of systematic elimination, because I scattered, albeit in a very regular fashion, the columns over the processors, the fact that I eliminated a whole block of them doesn't matter. And in this case example here, if you look at matrix algebra has no geometric structure. If you look at the fundamental algorithm, it takes the whole row or the whole column and does arithmetic. It doesn't take the column and the next. It doesn't take x of 1, and x of 2 is not anything special compared to x of 1. It's just x of 2, x of 3, x of 4 are sort of equally good variables. So matrices, although they're two-dimensional, do not have a geometric structure. And so they do not need a block distribution. Rather, they have the issue in matrix algebra is this load balancing issue. And so that's a very classic example, if you like, of where cyclic distributions are quite appropriate. So you should think, so cyclic are typically used where load balancing is either the only issue or the dominant issue. So let's do another example which shows the power of printing, because these black balloons and champagne bottles turn out white on the printer, but sort of interesting. But so this shows how unartistic I am. So here I have four processors, and I'm trying to render this picture of balloons floating next to a champagne bottle. So we don't have to discuss the fundamentals of computer graphics, except to note that the only thing we have to know about computer graphics is that the amount of work in computer graphics is actually a rather nonlinear function of the number of objects that a given pixel you have to traverse to calculate the color of a given pixel. And so there's far more work. Let's suppose these balloons and champagne bottles are just placeholders for some complicated object which takes a lot of rendering to reproduce. So here, there's a lot of work here and a lot of work here, very little work here and here, because there's nothing going on in the picture. So that, and the way we do computer graphics, we do in the simplest algorithms, we do each pixel independently. So it's actually even simpler than the matrix case. In the matrix case, rows and columns were essentially independent, but in the pixel case, each element is independent. So you see here the problem with the block distribution. One of the processors essentially has the entire champagne bottle, the other processor has the balloons, and the other two processors are doing essentially nothing. So a block, although a picture is a geometrical object, that's not what's important. What is important is what is the algorithm. The ray tracing algorithm is not a geometric algorithm. It's not a local algorithm. It's an algorithm that does each pixel independently. And so this is a terrible, so block is a terrible distribution for ray tracing. Rather, the block, the cyclic, which is the scattered, where you see the colors just scattered over the array, however, is going to work much better. And for a reason you can see that essentially what's characteristic of a pixel is set, of the ray tracing, is that the computational complexity is a very complex function of position. And what all you can really do is you're trying to derive an algorithm that works whatever the picture is. You need to find a distribution that's good, however complex the picture is, which means And the only natural way to do that is to use a cyclic or scattered distribution, which basically puts all processors everywhere in the picture. Because if you think what cyclic does, cyclic is taking a little template of mauve, green, blue, red, and basically replicating it. So in here, underneath these black balloons, there are lots of red and lots of mauve and lots of, there's lots of all the of each processor. So that's the best you can do. And as long as the size of the thing you're rendering, in here case the balloons and the champagne bottle, is sort of large, and they don't have a lot of pixels, as long as they have a lot of pixels in them, it's bound to be load balanced. So this is why we used to call it scattered. Because the intuitive idea is you just want to scatter, you can think of scattering the pixels over the processors so that even when you don't know how much work is attached to each processor, each pixel, statistically, an equal amount will be done. So this is a very important class of distribution, it's scattered. Now, so I should have drawn a picture for the block scattered, the block cyclic, or cyclic with a number. But we can discuss cyclic and a number for this particular case here, because there are going to be some implementations of this which will actually work better with the block cyclic. And the reason is the following. If you look into the theory, the way you do computer graphics, you would build these balloons and champagne bottles out of polygons, typically triangles. And those triangles are going to have a finite size. Now, if what you do is you scatter if you do a distribution which scatters the physical x, y positions over all the processors, you will find a given triangle spans several processors. And that produces intense complexity in the computation. And so it's actually much better to do the following. And this will be much better with a problem. What you need to do is you need to find a fundamental size which is large compared to the size of a triangle and small compared to the size of the object. And so let's suppose that in units of processors, four processors by four processors. And that's what you try to distribute over the array, because then you're going to guarantee, so you're going to guarantee that unit of 4 pixels by 4 pixels are geometrically close to each other, and so the triangles tend to lie inside a processor without a lot of geometrical overlap. But it's still small compared to the action, in this case the balloons, or the champagne bottle, so you still get load balancing. So there's a class of problems which have a mix of a load balancing issue and a geometrical issue. For that class of problem, block cyclic or cyclic with a number, as is done in the H-formal HBF syntax, is the right type of distribution. And so that's quite important. Although a lot of these are relatively complex applications, which is not so obvious you'd use HBF to do, but if we view this as an example of a classic type of distribution, this is a pretty important one. Again, if you read some of our early papers, we have some good examples of finite element problems which have this structure. When you take irregular finite element problems, you can do those with a block cyclic. Because if you do those with block, the irregularity leads to load imbalance. Because if you take a complex geometrical shape and superimpose it on a square array, you will find some of the processors don't have many elements in them. But if you do a block scattered, block cyclic, you can do a block cyclic in such a way that you've still got the geometrical locality, but also you get the loaded balancing because you don't have huge geometrical voids in any of these sort of fundamental templates you're distributing. So although I don't think in retrospect I've got quite the right discussion here, I would claim that HPF illustrates these three, which I would say three fundamental distributions, block cyclic, where you have to make the choice between, you know, so the way I again qualitatively describe between the multidimensional arrays, you do not always distribute each index, because if you distribute each index, either sometimes the indices have a lot of the partial differential equation algorithms treat the different indices differently, so you want to distribute them differently. And there's an important issue of this latency versus bandwidth, which will sometimes mean it's much better to use a block star rather than a block. Another interesting feature of block star, block star versus block, is if you're writing the message passing code, block is much harder to write than block star, because block star just distributes in one variable. And therefore, the messaging is only over one variable, and the other ones are just purely sequential. And so the lazy message passing code, and you will see this in a lot of examples in the literature, they're consciously making a simple choice. They will only distribute over one dimension. Not because that's correctly optimal, it's because if you distribute over two or three dimensions, the code gets rather ugly. And so one formal advantage of HPF over the explicit message passing is HPF as a language is equally elegant whether it's one, two, or three dimensions, because to go between them you can just change one, if you like, formally one statement. So that's meant to be the power of HPF. You can take an application and experiment. In fact, it's what you'd like to do, I think, for your project. You can experiment with a bunch of distributions extremely simply. Whereas if you do that with explicit message passing, it's much harder, because the code for these different the code is really quite different for these various dimensions. So typically with message passing, you make a choice and stick with it. You can do a little bit of performance tuning, but that's it. So this points out that if you combine a complex line with a standard distribution, you end up with a pretty complicated distribution. As I've said, I find that not important. It's formally allowed. Now, dynamic data mapping is extremely important, on the other hand. So, in fact, that's again probably worth a comment. So one of the reasons I'm skeptical about these complex mappings, which are formally allowed by a line, and especially a line, is my impression is that as soon as you get to complicated problems, you want to go something more complicated than block and cyclic. You want to go to some of these more customized resource allocation algorithms. And they also have to be dynamic and stuff. So you get into it, there's sort of two worlds. There's a simple, elegant world of matrices and FFTs and PDEs where block and cyclic is all you want. And then there's the real mess, which is the adaptive, irregular, dynamic problems. And I think you need different technologies for those two cases. And the classic static compiler analysis, which is built into the optimizable align and distributes, as far as I can see, are not terribly easy to apply to complicated problems. So. All right. So I already gave you this nice FFT example where there's a natural need, where the optimal algorithm actually does changes the distribution. And so there is a formal realign and redistribute statement in HPF. And they're a little different to distribute and align, because distribute and align are static compiler analyzable statements, whereas redistribute, which has an obvious meaning, you just change the distribution, is an executable statement, which can be controlled by if statements and all sorts of things. So it's a rather different type of structure, because, and as soon as you do that, the poor old compiler has a problem, because it doesn't actually know what's going on, because as I can control a redistribute by an if statement, or which is then runtime controllable, I cannot know what the distribution of my array is at any one time. And so there is a command called dynamic, and essentially that's in one of the reasons that's in there is to tell the compiler, you know, this array is probably going to be a lost cause. You're going to have to use a less sophisticated optimization strategy, because you're going to have to assume it has a dynamic distribution which you may not know at any one time what it is, which means that your code generation is going to be less efficient, because you're going to use indirection or something to calculate array indices and not some static algorithm. So now, I think we mentioned in 4.90 you can have allocatable arrays which can change their size, but allocatable arrays which you can use memory allocation to generate naturally have redistribution and realign attached to them. So I believe redistribution and realign are important. I mean, there are lots of problems you want to do that. A few with block, as I mentioned, for FFT. When we get to the more complex map directive, which is a general allocation in the map, we're just going to specify an array which tells you where each element of the template goes. So you specify a processor number of each template element. You think about, well, that's essentially all block, if you like, all these distributions are on assigning a processor number to an element of the template. So put this element somewhere. And the more general allocation algorithms just give you a more general methodology for assigning that number, which in general is just a user callable function. So here we have a case where we can either do realign or redistribute, and it's what you'd expect, but you do have to declare this to be dynamic. As I say, I would view that as important. So the only important comment here is that in Fortran 90 you can have allocatable arrays. Allocatable arrays do not have to be dynamic, so that says that when you allocate them, the compiler is responsible for generating them with the static distribution that they're meant to have. So in Fortran 90, dynamically allocated arrays just are required to be have the user-specified distribution command. You can also distribute pointers, and as far as distribute is concerned, arrays of pointers are distributed in the same way as ordinary arrays, and you distribute them by the index of the pointer array. Now, if you distribute a pointer array P cyclically, P of 1 goes in processor 1, P of 2 goes in processor 2, and so on. But they could point to things in totally different processors. P of 1 could be pointing to something in processor 3, and so on. So you don't distribute them by the target, you distribute them by the obvious thing, the index of the pointer array. Which is what you'd naturally want to do, because normally, a classic example of a pointer array would be you had a bunch of grid points, which were irregular, you might have a pointer array pointing to the nearest neighbors. So you could have, and so the index of that pointer array is actually a geometric index, which is the grid points, and so you'd want it to have it distributed in the same way as grid points, and not distributed according to the target, which would actually be geometrically local normally, but it would you'd have to calculate what that is. You want to just make certain that pointer array, if it's associated with grid element I, is distributed in the same way as the grid elements, because that's the natural physical thing you'd want to have. So there's a great deal of stress in HPF because of subroutines. And so I'm not a great expert on computer languages, but and there's this nifty word called first class. And basically what that means is what we did when we added the distribution command to Fortran 90, we did it by these effectively comment cards, which were ignored by the Fortran 90 compiler. And so that means that the distribution status of an array is not part, if you like, of the array object. It's not, there isn't an array object which has an attribute called how is it distributed. Whereas if I was designing a language from scratch, and I wanted it to be a parallel language, I would say every object ought to have a distribution attribute or a set of distribution attributes in the object. So when I would do so if I did this, if you came again to my lecture on Java on Monday, I would consider it natural to have either a method or a variable attached to each Java object, which is its distribution type or status or method for generating it. Because that the advantage of that is when you pass the array, you're passing information about its distribution. Whereas with the trouble we've put with this implementation strategy is that this poor old subroutine gets passed an array, which is a dummy array. It doesn't know what is in general how it's distributed. So this makes life rather complicated. And it's of course subroutines are incredibly important, and it's very important to get distributions correct in subroutines, because Fortran 90 and HPF get their power from calling intrinsics, which are subroutines or runtime. And so we're going to be calling huge libraries, matrix libraries. Which matrix libraries are going to assume a particular distribution of matrix of the parallel matrix. So this issue of passing distributions across subroutine boundaries is of great importance. So it's actually unfortunate that it's not so easy to do. And it's a rather inelegant case. So, there are about four cases, three or four cases, depending how you count. The first case is that the subroutine is written assuming a particular mapping. So a good example of that is matrix arithmetic. We use the LAPAC or ScalarPAC parallel matrix library that assumes a block cyclic distribution, because it knows the block cyclic is typically the optimal distribution for matrices. So I believe that will be an example of a library that will be coded with a particular distribution. And if the array ain't in that distribution, it must be remapped. So there's got to be effectively a redistribute command before the subroutine gets going. So it's got to have a wrapper around it which redistributes the data before it calls the hardcore parallel algorithm, which will only be coded for one particular distribution algorithm. Remember, we have this complication that, again, typically subroutines are pre-compiled. Although Kennedy would say that's the wrong thing to do. Kennedy would say that with today's technology, you do whole program compilation, and you hand the subroutines to the compiler to compile at the same time as the main program. But most people don't do that. They assume they've compiled the subroutine, and that's sitting there as an executable, and then they compile the main routine, or the main routines which call the subroutine, and so that means that that subroutine that was compiled at the time, it had no idea what the array's distribution was. So that's why Kennedy's approach of whole program compilation is technically much easier, because then you can have a single compiler which knows everything about the arrays and knows what was passed. So I would view this as the default. The default, which would happen in most cases with some predefined library, it's unreasonable for that library to be written with very many distributions, so we would essentially have to remap. However, especially if you happen to be doing whole program, or at least you're compiling at the same time, the subroutine in principle can be written so it can use any mapping. And then the argument should be passed and used with the current mapping. And then there's a special complication as to whether or not we need to remap due to array sections being passed. Because in Fortran 90, we're allowed to specify these array sections, which are extract subarrays from arrays, and a subarray doesn't have the same distribution as an array. It's related, but not the same. So there's a lot of complication. And that's meant to be so there's a new command called inherit, which essentially allows you to reference to the original distribution of the full array, which is what you need if you have sections of arrays and arguments. And there's a peculiar syntax involving asterisks, which is basically an instruction to leave the incoming distribution as whatever it was. And there are basically two cases: whether you know what the incoming distribution is, and you assert it with a distribute command in the subroutine, or you do not know what the incoming distribution is. What do we have here? So here we have a distribute command defined in a subroutine. This subroutine is called with a argument B, which is 800 elements of A. A is something of length 1,000, which then, when distributed onto 100 processors, gives 10. This is an incorrect. Let's assume the processor dimension is 10 here. Replace P of 100 by P of 10, because otherwise this doesn't make sense. So assuming P of 10, then 10 into 1,000 goes 100 times, which says the block size is 100 for A. But if I transmit a subarray of which is 800 in length, then if I inherit the distribution, which is what I do on the right-hand side, then B has block size of 100, and actually processors numbers 1 and 10 have no elements stored in them. If I just declare a distributed command inside the subroutine, then that's a block distribution which, as we have 800 elements over 10 processors, gives a block size of 80. So that illustrates the inherent complication of this type of again, it's a problem with the language. The language is so powerful, it allows a lot of things to happen, which therefore you have to have rules for what happens. I think in practice, this is not a big deal, because I think the dominant case you'd want to do remapping, and I do not believe array sections are particularly critical for anything other than something happen, which is what you'd which any reasonable person would expect to happen. So I think a lot of these difficulties and relatively peculiar syntaxes are again a result of a sophisticated, powerful language being taken a little too far, in my opinion. Alright, so that's the end of the discussion of distributions. I went through distribution in some detail, again, not because it's, for two reasons. It's certainly the heart of HPF. It is the most distinctive feature of HPF. And it really covers a lot of issues which are totally general. So these are the fundamental distributions, block and cyclic and block cyclic, which you can do almost all important algorithms with. We know, of course, that the fundamental, a compute's rule is trying to minimize communication, and that's, we've already illustrated that with the various choices in block. So there are a set of intrinsically parallel things. So remember, HPF, at least if we take the pure Fortran 90 syntax, is characterized by having explicit parallelism. And I would say that's a good idea. I believe explicit parallelism gives you determinism in what you want and what you're going to. You ought to get. You're writing something, and I think if you can express the as I said, if you can express the problem so the parallelism is transparent to either the compiler or the runtime system, that tells me that you've expressed the problem in a good fashion. So I find that this concept of implicit parallelism is almost an admission of failure, and sort of dangerous, because you may or may not find the parallelism. So implicit parallelism is very good where the parallelism in the problem is obscure, it's very difficult to find, you just want to hope that the runtime finds whatever parallelism there is. And so that's sort of good when Netscape is downloading 6 GIFs and spawning a chat system and 5 applets are running. You know, some sort of complex, irregular, dynamic, functional parallelism, that should not be done explicitly. That's sort of, we'll handle that in whatever way it appears natural. But this is not the case for data parallel algorithms. Data parallel algorithms, the parallelism is transparent to the user in almost every case. So I think one's goal should be to try to express it in a language where that parallelism is explicit. So I think the weakness of there in Fortran in HPF so if you compare HPF, say, with Fortran 77, the problem that many people would say that HPF has the problem that you have to make the parallelism explicit. Whereas in Fortran 77, you can just write a bunch of do loops and hope the compiler does it. And I explained with a couple of examples why that's not so obvious, whether it will or will not do it. So I would claim although I'm not certain I'm right here, but I'll claim it anyway, that we had the right idea when we chose Fortran 90. The problem was that it now appears that Fortran 90, in my opinion, will never get enough users to basically sweep the world. And that it's not because Fortran 77 is better than Fortran 90. Fortran 90 is much better than Fortran 77. It's object-oriented, it's et cetera. The trouble is the world's marched on. And I don't believe that people, the tired old faculty members will switch from Fortran 77 to Fortran 90. Existing codes will not get rewritten. Fortran 77 has a huge user base and a huge base of existing code, and I think Fortran 90 doesn't stand a chance of replacing Fortran 77 because of things like Java, which I think will preferably replace it. So that's sort of my problem. So the problem with HPF is that Fortran 90 has a small user base. Not that Fortran 90 is a bad language, it's an excellent language, I think. It's very focused on science and engineering, but that's okay. And it probably should have been done a little differently, but I don't think, my intuition is, just talking to people, I don't see a rush to Fortran 90. There's a few people, certainly it is used, and I think it's used for the correct reasons. It's a better language. But it's not used enough to to produce this momentum which will allow HPF to take off. Because HPF really can't do anything unless you have Fortran 90 as the base. I don't think it can. Alright, so I've already mentioned that, well, where is basically the array version of if. For all and independent do, we need to discuss, because if you look at most interesting HPF programs, the for all statement is the dominant form of parallelism, because what you can do with basic array instructions and the intrinsics is not enough. But for all is good, because for all is an explicitly parallel construct. So for all is not... So it is consistent for me to dislike do loops and Fortran 77, but to like for all, because for all has the semantics which says... which is explicitly parallel. Because it says, take all everything on the right-hand side, store it away somewhere and never touch it, calculate on the left-hand side, and then stick them where they're meant to go, which may be an array variables where you took right-hand sides from. And so for all is explicitly parallel. There's no possible interactions between the different do loop instances, different for all loop indices. And so it's a good syntax. So I see nothing wrong in using for all, because you can guarantee parallelism. It's actually quite difficult to compile for all, because there are lots of optimizations which you can do to make it more efficient, both in communication and also data storage. So it's very difficult to implement. It's actually much easier to implement array statements. But I think, intellectually excellent construct. So what does this say? This we've already done. So this just says that you can do any array instructions, A equals B, sets array A equal to array B, you can set B equal to B plus 1, adding 1 to every element of B. You can set B1 to 99 equals B2 to 100, which just shifts B by 1. Or you can use these array elements, B of 10 equals B of 11, which of course effectively are evaluated in scalar mode and will not give you any parallelism. I think we've done lots of examples by that. and they have obvious parallelism. So the where statement is a pretty useful statement, which you use in the array syntax. So it's, so an example here is where a is greater than not, a is you just subtract 100 from each element of a, and it has the syntax, the semantics, if you like, of for all, namely you evaluate everything without any interference, and you store everything in temporaries, and you only set the result in the element A at the end. So all these array instructions have to have that syntax. Is why I do B of 2 to 100 equals B of 1 to 99. These are shifting with array sections. Unless I had the semantics that I store the right-hand side secretly in a temporary, do the computation, and then store back the left-hand side, I get interference. So all these array instructions have this semantics that there is no interference with any loop indices, any loop instances. And it's the interference between the different loop instances which destroys classic parallelism in any language, Fortran, C, C++. It's what makes for loops very, very difficult to parallelize in any language. All right, so that's, I guess, a reasonable place to start. Stop. So you should then get some discussion for all and HBF2, which are the main things to follow here, and some real live examples of actual real HBF code as case studies. And you will you'll find that the homework on the web, which is homework 5, is meant to, you're meant to use Qvang's virtual programming lab, and you are all meant to have, and Saleh has just left, you're all meant to have passwords for that lab. And he claims to have found all bugs but one, but says you won't notice the bug he hasn't found. So I challenge you to find bugs. Extra credit will be given to all bugs, because we want to get the bugs out. Okay, thank you.